Welcome to Off Script with Dan Dwyer on Robinhood Radio, featuring in-depth interviews with guests from the world of theater and allied arts. Underwriting support from Johnny Cake Books in Salisbury, Connecticut, whose collection of rare collectible and out-of-print books is housed in a 19th century cottage in one of the most old-fashioned small towns in New England. And now, here's the host of Off Script, Dan Dwyer.
Well, thank you, Marshall. And under the rubric of allied arts, on occasion, instead of talking about theater, we talk about books when it's worth it. And today's discussion about a book is going to be very well worth it. I'm talking today with the author John Burnham Schwartz about his new book, one of the most imaginatively conceived and executed pieces of fiction I've read in a long, long time. The title of the book is The Red Daughter, and it's a fictionalized account of the private life of Svetlana Stalin, paced from her defection to the United States in 1967. The author, John Burnham Schwartz, is a part-time resident of Salisbury and best-selling novelist of five books, including The Northwest Corner, which was set right here in the northwest corner of Connecticut, and also Reservation Road, which was made into a film for which John wrote the screenplay. John's other screenwriting credits include the HBO miniseries on Bernie Madoff, The Wizard of Lies, for which John was nominated for a Writers Guild of America award. Welcome, John.
Thank you, Dan. Nice to be here.
Congratulations on the book. I finished it last weekend, and it's really brilliantly conceived and really uniquely structured and beautifully composed, as is most of your writing. But I'm almost as intrigued about the fictionalized story that you tell, as I am about the real story behind the story, and how you put this imaginative composition together. So let's start first with the factual premise, a germination of the book, and then talk about what the imagination and what the imaginative story of the book is about, okay?
Of course.
Sure.
I would probably begin, I guess, by giving two moments in time. The first from the midlife of a woman's life, of course, and the second 45 years later at the time of her death. And of course, as you mentioned, it's not just any woman, it's the daughter of Joseph Stalin. But let's go back to April of 1967. It's the height of the Cold War, and it's 14 years after the death of Stalin. And his daughter, his only daughter and his only surviving child, defects to the West. And she goes, first defects in India, and then makes her way to Switzerland, where for a number of very tense weeks, she's waiting to see if the United States will accept her. And she was at the time and remains the most significant Soviet citizen ever to defect to the West. And just to give a little window into how insane that event was in the global celebrity and history of the time, when she arrived at the end of April 1967 at JFK Airport and set foot on American soil for the first time, there were more press and more people waiting for her than there had been for the Beatles 3 years earlier.
But she was accompanied, and I'm getting to the germination of the novel, by someone that you know very well.
That is very true. And so 45 years later, maybe a less celebrated moment, I'm in my house in Brooklyn in November of 2011. I go out and get the paper, the actual paper, and there on the front page is a huge headline that says Lana Peters, which was the name she went by at the end of her life. Lana Peters, Stalin's daughter, dead at 85. And as I begin to read this obituary and then move into the inside page, it's a huge obituary, there is a photograph that stops me in my tracks. And it does so because it's a photograph I recognize. It had been on the wall of my house when I was growing up and had seen all through the years in my father's offices. And I recognize the two people in it. It's Svetlana, that day in April. She's just 41 years old. And she is standing there at JFK surrounded by microphones, and right next to her, smiling, and she's smiling at him, is my father, who was then 34 years old and was the lawyer sent over in the middle of the night under CIA cover to go fetch her and bring her back into the States. And he was, for the first 8 to 10 years that she was in the country. He was her lawyer, advisor, and friend and closest advisor. And she stayed with us that summer when I was two, and then continued to stay with us on and off over those years. And she was sort of a regular figure in our lives. I was very young, but I do remember. But that's how I began work on the Red Daughter the next morning. Let's put it that way.
Amazing.
Some years ago.
And it's an amazing, probably the most amazing story about the origins of a book of fiction that I've ever heard of. What's really compelling about the book is that there are two central characters. Okay, so tell us a little bit more about Svetlana's personal psyche as you have imagined it, and also about the character Peter, who is her attorney, and how they go forward.
Yes. So I would say there were two access points when I tried to think of how to get inside this novel about the daughter of a man who was responsible for the death of more than 20 million of his own people. I thought about two things. I thought about her voice, and I thought about that photograph, which, of course, to me, epitomized my father's role in her life more than even my father's character, but my father's, the role that he played. And so her voice in actual life, as she moved, into America and began and got older and began to express herself more and more in English, and some of her paranoia, perhaps an exaggeration of conspiracies, grew. She was a very challenging woman, very intelligent, but also challenging. Her voice to me came to seem almost, it went from being an open hand to being a fist, and then over the years to being a fist that was clenched more and more tightly. And my father opened up to me his 40 years of files on her. And though he had ceased being her lawyer in the mid 70s, she continued to write him over the decades. And seeing the letters that she actually wrote, and seeing even in the handwriting and the words on the page, the words being capitalized more and more often and filled with exclamation marks and underlines, I thought that there, in some sense, and maybe this is just the arrogance of the novelist, that her voice, as it turned out to be, did not seem commensurate in its expressiveness with what I, by that time, having read a great deal, knew about her life. And I wanted to find a related but different voice in order to tell her story. So that's one thing. The other thing was the point of view of the lawyer. And so if you open The Red Daughter, the first thing you encounter is an editor's foreword. And that is written by Peter Horvath, who is now in his 80s and widowed and alone. And he holds that position that my father held, and he tells us how he first heard about her death, and then he hadn't seen her for some time, and then how he brought her into the country and what she represented. And then he lets us know that what we're going to be reading are in fact the unpublished journals that she had begun writing the very day that she arrived in America in 1967 and ran through all the way to the end of her life, and that he, in some sense, would be acting as her editor, though it's clear that his relations with her were more intimate and far closer than that, than even her lawyer, and that he has an emotional investment in that story. And so we'll be hearing from him, too, at times. And then we begin her story on that first day as she takes us back into the beginning of her life, trying, in a sense, to understand how she arrived at this moment of defection. And so that's the structure of the book. And in a way, it's those two voices that we have going back and forth, and their voices her voice particularly changes as she ages. Now, those journals, I should add, are fictional. I know they are because I wrote them. They didn't actually exist.
In case you're just joining us, my guest is John Burnham Schwartz. He's the author of an incredibly compelling new book called The Red Daughter, which is a fictionalized account of the personal life of Joseph Stalin's daughter, Svetlana. John will be in Salisbury, actually, on Tuesday night, May 21st, at the White Hart at 6 o'clock, both reading from and signing copies of his book to be purchased there. How long did it take you, John, to really wrestle and come up with that structure? You know, the editor's note being Peter Howard's commentary on the journals and then the fictionalized version of the journals.
So, yeah, it took about 2 years.
Yeah.
This is the inefficiency of novel writing. But the truth is, especially with a historical novel like this, the structure is so important. And I did have, I had Peter Horvath as a character right from the beginning, sort of framing the book. But in fact, and this is probably way too Nabokovian, instead of giving him his own chapters here and there through the book, I had his comments about Svetlana and about her story and the way in which he participates in the telling of her story and is a character in her story. I had all of that originally in footnotes, which, you know, probably doesn't sound that successful, understandably, because the footnotes began to grow and grow until, you know, like some horrible weed, they took over the entire manuscript. So then I finally realized that he needed his own place. And the reason for that, I think, is that Svetlana, as I mentioned, was a very challenging person. Now, if you were the daughter of a monster, you might be too. And she really did spend her entire life looking for a home and looking for a sense of self and trying to show the world and herself that she was not her father's daughter. And she never really succeeded. So in order to find a window of greater sympathy for her, I felt that Peter's expanded role was necessary. And I felt also that in some way he allowed her, by loving her and seeing her as he did, he allows her a certain greater sympathy for herself.
Right.
This is a person who really never loved herself and never felt loved.
And from a critical point of view, it's just a facile way to not only move the story economically, yes, but also to heighten the underpinning conflict between their intimate relationship.
Yes, that's very true. And, you know, his role, of course, is the most fictionalized reach I made in writing this novel. You know, having read more than 36 books and so many letters and papers, I did all the research I felt I possibly could. And then you begin to write what you set out to write, which is a novel. And that has to get inside and express the interiority of these characters, right, and their life experiences. And so, you know, I think Svetlana, it is a difficult relationship between the two of them. But at the same time, you know, I think if we'd only heard from her, we would have been locked into a very difficult corner in some sense.
You haven't used the term love story.
That's interesting. No, I haven't. You know, that doesn't roll off my lips that easily.
No, but also and I'm not trying to be pejorative, but it also makes it sound so much less than what it is. The relationship between these two is so wonderfully complicated, but
yes,
so human at the same time.
It lasts decades. And I would say most of all, because the actual romantic part between them isn't that successful and certainly causes pain and trouble and doesn't last that long, but their whole relationship does. And they see each other in a way that nobody else has seen them.
Yep.
And, you know, for her, he's the only one in this country who does.
Mm-hmm.
And for him, you know, though he remains married in an unhappy marriage his whole life, and, you know, she saw him. And that means an incredible amount to him. And also, she's the most exciting thing that ever happened to him. And in some way, I wanted that essence to suggest her arrival in this country, that part of the Cold War that we now, many of us, forget, and the sense of both fear, confusion, suspicion, but also excitement and kind of event that existed in those days in the late 60s and early 70s. Right. And, you know, the decisions that she makes from the moment she arrived, including her defection, leaving two mostly adult children back in Russia, which is something that causes her immense guilt the rest of her life. The decisions she makes, which are almost incredible in the directions they send her through history over the next 40 some years, they can only really be understood in emotional terms. She was not an agent of the KGB or the CIA. In fact, neither entity knew what to do with her. She was such a strong and challenging person who was so emotionally driven. She was not shrewd. She was not canny. She did not care about money and did not even fully understand it in many ways, though she would make an immense amount of money when she first arrived because of the publication of her memoir. That money would disappear. She was just constantly, as I said before, looking to find a place, you know. And when the day she arrived at JFK, she announced in her own words in English that she believed that one could be at home wherever one felt free. And that's a wonderful statement. But if you look at it in light at the end of her life, in light of all that has happened, you have to say that she probably never felt free and never felt home or found a place to land.
In case you've just joined us, my guest is John Burnham Schwartz. We're talking about his new book, The Red Daughter, a fictionalized account of the private life of Svetlana Stalin. John, do you have ready a brief passage from the book that you could share with us?
Yes, I do. And if you'll just give me one second.
Okay. And then after that, you had mentioned, yes, while you're looking for the passage, then after you read that section, I'd like to talk a little bit about the research in the book, because there's so much in the book that is so socially and culturally and politically accurate to the times. But anyway.
So this is just a brief thing in which she's talking about her father, Joseph Stalin, and about money. My father never had a bank account. The state paid for everything, and the head of the state, of course, incurred no expenses of his own. He was the state, and anything he wanted he would simply order, and it would arrive or be done. He liked to keep a bit of petty cash in his pockets for appearances' sake, but he had no conception of money's true worth. He received a salary, but he did not know its value as currency, did not know what to do with it on any significant scale. So he did nothing. Every month, a large packet filled with money was delivered to his home office, and there on his desk, the unopened packets would accumulate month after month after month, until with time they grew into a hazardous mountain that could be neither climbed nor ignored, at which point he ordered his bodyguard, Vlasic, who kept him supplied with the little trifles of cash that he liked to carry on his person, to unpile the large packets and move them to a storeroom, where they would be piled again and begin the wait to be joined by more large packets in the years to follow. Some of these disappeared into the trunk of Vlasic's car or into the dachas of commandants and generals. My father sensed these thefts, but for all his suspicions, could never prove them, because every single item of the bookkeeping was faked anyway, lies upon lies without a trace, but mostly because he did not understand money in personal terms. This was the man, after all, who in the late 1940s, after the Soviet Union had won the war, as he was fond of saying, still mentally ascribed to the ruble its pre-revolutionary value, when 100 rubles might be considered a fortune, and wore the same musty, tobacco-smelling tunics as when my mother had believed him, in the glory days of the party, a savior and hero of the people. "Do you need money?" he would demand when I saw him then, once or twice a year. "How much?" There was nothing tender in the way he asked the question, nor did he wait for an answer. He would press into my palm, in a gruff handshake, 2,000 or 3,000 rubles that he tugged from his pockets and send me on my way, somehow convincing himself that he'd just made me a millionaire.
That was John Burnham Schwartz reading from his new book, The Red Daughter. I vividly remember that passage, among many others. we could go on and on about the personality of Svetlana, but I'd like to talk a little bit in the couple of minutes, 5 minutes we've got left, about how you create the world of the United States, the culture of the United States when she came here. I knew that you grew up in a very literary household. I also know that you're a little younger than I am. But the period that you really describe with incredible detail to my memory is that period between 1969 and like the early 1970s. And you reference you create this perfect world in Princeton where Svetlana was living in a rarefied academic environment, intellectual environment. And she's watching the Dick Cavett Show. Which was at the time. You reference a group of actors that were on the literary cutting, a group of authors at the literary cutting edge at the time, Donald Barthelme. And you resurrect the long-forgotten anecdote about the controversy of the plagiarism of Jerzy Kosinski in The Painted Bird.
Yes.
Yeah. Now, so I knew your background's really literary. Do you remember that yourself? Because if you did, you were a pretty precocious social observer at the time, because you are younger than I, or how did you reconstruct that?
So, you know, I mean, one of the pleasures of being a novelist is doing research like a novelist, in which you are mostly obsessed, first of all, with not getting it wrong, the period or the place, but also with details that seem to be imbued, details of a person, a place that seem to be imbued with particular emotional or psychological resonance. And Jerzy, of course, was a very different kind of emigre. And my father did represent him. And I do remember Jerzy quite well. He committed suicide, I think it was at the end of the 70s. And he was a very complicated figure. And he and Svetlana actually did know each other.
Is that right?
Yes. Yeah. And, you know, it was a time when all of these people knew each other in one way or the other. For instance, Svetlana and Tatiana Tolstoya met. Of course they did. They were the two most famous Russian immigrants in some ways, and with their pedigrees. And of course they hated each other on sight. They recognized each other immediately as types and people, and they represented very different types of people, and each thought the other. Each accused the other in some fashion of not doing the right thing. But as I said, Svetlana was not political, and she was above all emotional. And Jerzy was a very attractive, almost seductive figure. He was very famous at that time, and he was very debonair, and he was very exotic in a certain way. My father believes he wrote The Painted Bird, and I believe that as well.
Right.
To what it was certainly not factually true, much of it. And he was a person who created his own biography many times over. And when you consider the fact that he committed suicide, you have to dwell on that for a bit and think about all the different layers of untruth and fictionalization that allowed him to go from Poland to becoming this extremely famous, well-off, and sophisticated person here in America, but it didn't really last. Svetlana would get crushes, very intense, on certain people. Mm-hmm. I think she got one on Jerzy, though I don't think it was reciprocated.
Right. We could make a whole discussion around Svetlana's time at Taliesin, the Frank Lloyd Wright communities, both in the Southwest and in Minnesota. But she had a son out of that experience, and he's still...
She had a daughter. I changed her to a son to protect privacy.
And I was going to ask you if you had heard from any...
I have not. So okay. I wanted... She helped... She was a participant in the writing of a good biography on Svetlana that came out about 5 years ago called Stalin's Daughter by Rosemary Sullivan. And I feel that I have a very good sense of the turbulent, though ultimately loving, relationship between Svetlana and her American child, mm-hmm. whom she had at 45. The father was the son-in-law of Frank Lloyd Wright.
Right.
That whole situation at Taliesin, which was, It's safe to say a disaster that ended after 2 years, disaster for Svetlana, could have been a novel in itself, needless to say.
And we could have another discussion all around that. But right now, I have to thank you, John, for coming on and for talking about The Red Daughter. And congratulations. It's a wonderful book.
Thank you, Dan. I look forward to being in Salisbury Tuesday night. Thanks
Tuesday
so
night
much.
At the White Hart Inn, John Burnham Schwartz will be signing and reading from his book, The Red Daughter. And I hope you all can make it there. Again, thanks to John for coming on the program. And thanks to everyone for listening. As a dear departed friend of mine used to say before we meet each other next time, be well.
Underwriting support for Off Script with Dan Dwyer from John and Cake Books in Salisbury, Connecticut, whose collection of rare, collectible, and out-of-print books is housed in a 19th-century cottage in one of the most old-fashioned small towns in New England. Off Script with Dan Dwyer is also available via podcast on our on-demand page, robinhoodradio.com. Click on On Demand, and then click on Off Script with Dan Dwyer.